to order, and today is February 5th, 07. And welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2062. And now I'm trying to remind the committee. Yes, please do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2062 is the measure that requires operators and passengers of Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicles to wear motorcycle helmets with a fastened chin strap. You do have in your materials the Dash 1 amendments, which exempt an employee of a utility that provides electrical, water, gas, or telecommunication services in the performance of that employee's official duties from wearing a motorcycle helmet with a fastened chin strap. Now, you'll see that exemption, that new language happening twice. It's reordering. The Dash 1 amendments are just restating the list of exemptions from the requirement. You'll see on lines 10 and 11 and again on lines 26 and 27. And so it's repeating those lists that apply in the first case to an exemption from the offense of failure to wear the helmet while operating those ATVs on premises open to the public, and then the second one references the offense of endangering an operator or passenger of an ATV. It provides that utility employee exemption to that current list that you see and kind of reorders it. We do have a no revenue impact. We're still waiting for the fiscal on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Members, it had been my intent to adopt the amendments and pass this bill out today, but there was another amendment that someone had an interest in, and that was the loading and unloading, which did not get drafted. So as it stands right now, I think we've opened it. We'll probably go ahead and request that amendment be drafted and then bring this back and pass it out. And does anyone have any questions or comments? Or thank you for putting up with me on this one. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on 2062. And Judith will request those amendments. And we'll bring it back. And then we also, I am going to open the work session on House Bill 2176. And if Judith would like to remind us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2176 is the measure that removes the state health officer from the obligation of determining medical eligibility to safely operate a motor vehicle. It establishes that responsibility within the Department of Transportation, and it would allow the department to employ and enter into an agreement with any qualified physician, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant as determined by rule to perform those duties. Currently, we have in our possession the Dash 2 amendments, which would direct the Department of Transportation to provide for probationary driver licenses. Excuse me, they'd be called probationary driver permits. And it as well provides, instead of the department determining by rule those qualified to make that determination, it would be all those who hold an unrestricted license in the state of Oregon, that is a qualified physician, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant, could be employed by the department to perform that role. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to call up Jack Evans and Grant Higginson, and they can kind of tell us where we are on this amendment and bill.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. And we were just about ready to go with this today. The amendments that I wanted to talk to you about were those that corrected what was seen as a potential problem with this bill, and that's the scenario where an in-house physician would be employed by the same agency that makes a determination that an individual either would be suspended or would be denied the interstate waiver. And we thought we had corrected that, but we found out today we didn't go far enough. We had corrected a part that said when a person is suspended, rather than having an administrative hearing, they'd be eligible for a contested case hearing, which would bring in an administrative law judge, and it'd be a third party and be what everyone would consider to be due process. And it was brought to our attention today that, well, that's only half of it. There are situations not in which an individual is suspended, but in which they're denied eligibility for an intrastate waiver. And in those situations, it still is unclear that they would have a contested case hearing. And so what this latest amendment would do would make it absolutely clear that in both those situations, an individual that was denied or suspended would have the right to a case hearing, a contested case hearing, and therefore there'd be proper due process.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm not going to add much more than Jack has already said. We remain supportive of the bill because we think it will provide regulatory streamlining, more efficiencies to the program, and just a better alignment with the work that needs to be done there. As I testified last time, we were waiting on some amendments. Most of them were very minor housekeeping things which have been provided, but the critical amendment did deal with the contested case hearing. We think that is an important piece in the way of amendments to this bill, and are simply awaiting that to be corrected to a language that we can all live with and we think is fair and just.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gilman.
I have a couple. Then these dash two amendments don't solve all the problems that you have. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, that is correct. The dash two get halfway there. If you're suspended, you have a contested case hearing available to you. But if you're denied up front, your eligibility for the medical waiver, then it's not clear that you do have it. This corrects that.
Okay. And then one more,
yes.
Madam Chair. Thank you. There's no fiscal on this. And Jack, I may be confused if it was a hearing here or in my office, but I got the impression you're paying for this physician anyway. So tell me, is it pretty much a push of the cost to the department?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, yes, that's my understanding. We're pretty much paying for this now. The only thing down the line that needs to be hashed out is position authority.
Any other questions?
So we're waiting for
yes. Okay. So, well, we thought we had this ready to go, but we don't. So I'm going to thank you. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2176 and bring that back again when we have the amendments. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2567.
Madam Chair, members, HB 2567 exempts a person from the offense of unlawful use of metal objects on tires if that person uses tires with retractable studs during specified times. You do have a copy of the Dash 1 amendments. Those do completely replace the original measure, except it does, and I will point out, it has one piece of the language still the same, but essentially it is a replacement of the original measure. The Dash 1 amendments allow retractable studded tires to be treated as traction tires under the Oregon Transportation Commission rules. It defines retractable studded tires, and you'll see that definition beginning on page 1, line 21, And please note that it allows them only when a vehicle operator extends those studs to augment traction of the vehicle in that, those particular weather conditions. It deletes the term extending and replaces it with projecting when they're referencing a violation exemption for vehicles equipped with retractable tires when those metal studs or other material are projecting beyond the tread surface to correctly reference how those now studs might be projected and then retracted from the tire. And those, again, would still be allowed to be used only between November 1st and April 1st. And then the duplicated language from the original bill allows the tire dealer to sell tires equipped with non-lightweight studs if those studs are indeed retractable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Cindy Roberts and Mike O'Brien, if you'd like to come up. Yes, ma'am. I've missed this. I've heard about you and your tire. But
Madam Chair, members in the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I am proud to represent Q Tires in Oregon. It's pretty interesting. I've been doing this for almost 17 years now, and I'm always talking about public policy, and I'm always on one side, and other people are on the other side. And in this case, it's not policy. It's a product, and there is nobody on the other side. This is a universally pretty exciting product. It's a retractable stud. And statute and the people who wrote it could not have foreseen of such a possibility. So we're trying to change the statute in all the states that have studded tire laws to make it so that these studded tires, if they are below retracted and ours retract below the tread bar, if they're retracted below, you can use them year-round. But more importantly than listening to me, Mike O'Brien, who lives in Tualatin, is the founder of this company and the inventor of the product. He conceived of it quite some time ago, and I'd like to have him tell you his story.
Oh, great. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and to speak on behalf of this bill. I grew up in the state to the south. Are we allowed to use its
identify yourself?
Sorry, my name is John Michael O'Brien, inventor of the study technology being soon to be sold by the Q Tire Company. Just a real quick background. I grew up in a place where snow and ice were not an issue whatsoever. It was a beach in that state to the south that I tended to spend lots and lots of time admiring waves and sands and all that went with it, and never had much need except going to the mountains to go skiing to go through snow or ice. The opportunity to be transferred to the Midwest to discover what real weather looked like came about my early 20s when I had children who needed to get around, and we lived at the bottom of a teacup, and the snow and ice showed up. We couldn't get out, and I was frustrated. That frustration led over a period of about 30 years to trying to find some simple method that would allow for traction to be available when needed, and when not needed, it would go away. The technology that you see before you is a fairly simple system to understand. It's very complicated in terms of engineering and manufacturing. The point was, in my mind, that if I didn't have to put chains on, I'd be a happy camper. And that was the only possible methodology. If you had snow and ice and you're going up a hill to get there, that was before studs were invented. Once studs came into being, they were certainly a great advancement over putting chains on, but unfortunately they tended to have a difficult effect, I should say, on road surfaces. Most of us are aware of the fact that vehicles change over the years. Their shape their design, what they're powered by. Theoretically, we'll have a brand new kind of fuel that comes out in the next several years that will change everything about how we move from point A to point B. The design of a tire has not changed for a good number of years. 1945 was the advent of the radial tire as opposed to bias ply tire. Soon we'll have, even with the casing itself, a change where a run flat design will be most likely incorporated in most of the tires that you ride around on. Tires are the one thing that are unlikely to change, unless we learn to levitate. No matter what the shape of the vehicle, no matter what powers them, a tire is going to be the same. And only the tread, frankly, is going to be the thing that will not change at all. And the reason for that, quite simply, is that the little channels you see in that rubber are required to move water out from under the tire as you're going down a wet road, or if you get in snow and icy conditions, there needs to be something that grips whatever that condition is in order to give you traction. If we lived in South Florida or Southern California and very rarely saw rain or snow, we'd all ride around on slicks. A slick is simply a tire with no tread. Gives you maximum road contact and those little footprints that all of us are so dependent upon. What we've found over the years is that if you can turn a tire tread into a smart technology where at the right time when you need to, you can have it extend a metal or some other substance that can grip snow and ice and gets you through whatever you need to get through, and then find a way to retract it out of the way so you don't destroy the road, that's excellent. If you can also have one set of tires to run on throughout the year, that's a good thing too. At the same time, if you're in the infrastructure preservation business, you want to make sure that whatever people run on, they have a chance to cooperate with you and not having to resurface those roads year in and year out. A third win for a tire like this is that if you've ridden on studs during wet and dry conditions, you know how noisy they are. And frankly, they take away about 20% of your ability to corner and stop. The technology that you see is a simple matter of equalizing air pressure between the tire itself and little chambers. And if you see the pieces of tread that have been passed around, there's little chambers behind the tread section that allow for those little pods to be pushed up so that they're about even with the top of the tire tread. And that's all we need, because as the tire rolls through its footprint, it compresses the tire around these studs and it gets you great traction with snow or ice. My hope is that we'll be able in the state of Oregon to sell these tires on the basis they can be used year-round, so that one, the consumer only needs one set of tires, two, when they do need the traction, they've got it, and three, when they don't, they're not tearing up your roads or making it unsafe for the drivers that do use them, you know, during the current season to run around on wet or dry. That, I think, is about as much as I can say in a short time, so I'll stop.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just so I get the gist of this, so a consumer with these tires on their vehicle, they would have to, if they ran into icy conditions, they'd have to get to a gas station to use air to put these?
No, that tire is a great big air tank. And what happens is that we have a remote device that allows for us to activate a little three-way valve that equalizes air pressure between the small chamber, the tire itself, and you can do that 30, 40, 50 times before you lose significant air pressure in that tire. So remote activation from inside the car allows you, when you see or feel difficulty arising, to give you your traction, and then as soon as it goes away, you can press a button and they'll retreat back to their position.
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, and this is not a far-off technology. Currently, right now, in the Chevrolet cars, the Tahoe, the Suburban, they have a sensor, a remote sensor for air pressure,
right.
Radial air pressure in each of the tires, and it reads how much air pressure you have and sends it back to your dash. This is the same kind of thing.
Wow.
Any other questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you can't demonstrate.
I can.
If I could
come to the tire, I'd be happy to do that.
Come to the tire.
Yeah, the treads that you all have in front of you, you'll see that the stud is actually dimpled down beneath the actual tire. You can see right here it's dimpled. And that's, again, just to help keep it further away from the tread. When the tread is totally ripped off of this tire, these studs would still not hit the ground because of the dimple. This tire was produced before we did the dimple effect. So you see there is no dimple in this tire. That's because we've had it for a while. Mike is so kind, he wanted to make me a little tired to bring and show all of you, but I thought this had a better effect, and it's as close to being an auto show girl as I'll ever get. So I'm going to flip the switch, which you would do from your remote control, and you'll be able to see it, hopefully, as you're all sitting here. They'll start to push out. I lift it up so you can see it better, but... Ready?
Mm-hmm. Huh. Oh, my gosh.
Now, you'll notice that they don't come up very far, but they don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, see, that's the beauty of it, is that studded tires ride on, you know, pretty much a big chunk of metal that goes down the street, and you can hear them. These are compressed against air, and they give both traction and a soft compression against the road, so you don't tear them up. Even if you have them out when you shouldn't, they're not going to tear the road up near like a solid piece of rubber behind a regular stud. This is an old version. We were at the DOT show here last November. We had a button that you pushed. They came out, and it was all dimpled down. We just have these things out around the country, and I wasn't able to get one here today, but I can bring one back if you like. So the idea is that if you remember James Bond, he had this little device. We pressed a button, and he took off. The bad guys couldn't catch him, and he could do everything they couldn't do. This is just simply a very small version of what he had, but I think a very practical version that so far we've been on ice rinks and all over the country with them. They work pretty well.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Share with the committee what safety testing you've had done on this tire.
I'm sorry?
If you could share with the committee what safety testing you've had done with this tire.
USDOT 139 is the latest one that we've just finished, which is the test that every tire must go through starting this year. We've also had an auto testing test a early prototype of this on ice and snow. We will soon go through the UTQG, which basically gives you the lettering on the side of the tire in terms of heat durability and so on and so forth. We're about to go through that phase now.
How we did on the DOT test?
Hmm?
Tell them how we did on the DOT test.
DOT test passed with flying colors. We have a tire that can be rated at pretty much any speed we want it to. Equal to or better than most of the tires you'll find on the showrooms of most of the tire dealers you'll run into.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you share with the committee what the cost per unit is and then also the useful life of a tire?
The tread depth from top of stud to top of tread is roughly 7/32. We've been told by the folks that we've hired in Akron that we can get roughly 50,000 miles out of that current configuration. Cost will be roughly 30% above what you pay for a similar type of tire.
Follow-up. Clarification. A similar studded tire?
No, actually a similar performance tire. In other words, this tire is designed basically to be unidirectional, to be run at a reasonable speed. Add 30% and you get reasonable speed plus great traction when you need it.
Can I ask just one last question? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you share with the committee, have you had any discussions with the major auto dealers? Because to me it seems as if that's a key component of the success of this vehicle, getting them on board.
Yeah, an OEM product would certainly be to our advantage. What we've determined, however, is that in order to go to an OEM level, you've got to, first of all, get lots of them out on the roadway and demonstrate through many, many miles of people using them, consumer use, that you get what you want. We've had inquiries from a number of companies wanting to know what our interest might be, but we've basically said at this point we need proof of the pudding, massive fleet testing, if you will, with consumers using these under all conditions. At that point, then, we think we might have some interest.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, with regard to the stud component itself, it appears that the overall actual rubber is a little bit thinner, a little bit more pliable there. Any loss of studs through the process of your trials and so forth, and is the stud material of equal or greater value for gripping than studded tires are presently?
Material that you see running around now, the thickness of the rubber around the pod is sufficient so that we think it will last as long as the tire itself, even if you ran the stud out all the time. We have not designed these studs to be of the same hardness as a stud that you'd find in normal permanently studded tires because, one, we don't anticipate most people will leave them out once the opportunity for their use is gone. Two, we're pushing, again, up against a compressible pod versus a solid piece of rubber. So we're not going to get near the impact on that stud. Now, we could spend the money to go to a tungsten hardness or whatever else they put in a regular stud. We may do that over time if we determine that that's necessary. But right now, we've discovered that these hold up pretty well under most conditions.
And so, Mike, with a tire that starts getting 50,000 miles on it and you're wearing the tread out, what's the notification back to the system that hey, you're running, you're actually hitting metal to the ground?
Our intention is to have a visually obvious event take place on this tire. For instance, we envision being able to put silica portions throughout the tread face that show up at roughly 430 seconds, that as you're spinning down the highway, that's just above the top of the stud, those yellow silica items will show up very plainly, and you'll know, hey, it's time to replace the tire.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear on House Bill 2567, so what this is going to do is allow for almost kind of a pilot project for the state to allow this type of tire to be run year-round on Oregon highways. Is that a fair assessment?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure that a pilot project is really the right answer. We want to be able to use the tires year-round because the studs do not touch the ground, which was the original intent of statute. This bill has passed in Montana and Idaho unanimously so far to do the same thing, so pilot project wouldn't be quite correct. Secondarily, I wanted to add that ODOT did, in fact, write the Dash 1 amendment. So Doug Tindall, we went and showed him and Matt Garrett and Joan Plank the product. They were most excited by it, and the bill was drafted by them. The first attempt had some errors in it, and they didn't quite get where they wanted us to be. So Doug Tindall worked with Legislative Council to rewrite with the Dash 1s, which we're happy to accept if it makes them happy.
Just a comment. If and when we pass this, and to me I see no reason why we wouldn't, we're going to create a heck of a market for a new business, and I assume you're from the state of Oregon? For a citizen from the state of Oregon, that's exciting.
Representative, it's one of the things that excites me most about this product is here I am working for something that was started in right in the metropolitan area where I live, and here I am talking about something brand new, and it's an exciting thing. It's done well in the other states. We're also pushing in Washington right now, and we haven't had any problems thus far. We're excited about it.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, if I understood you during your testimony, you said that after about 40 times of inflating and deflating or using the studs that you may have to put more air in the tire. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, sir. The design is such that you have a little button that you have on your visor or wherever you choose to put it, and whenever you push the button, it's going to give you a nice flashing light so you know they're extended, but it'll also give you a counter. So that after 40 times, a little yellow light will go off on this device and it will say, well, you may want to check your air pressure. Now, the next iteration of this device will also give you on your controller air pressure for each tire so that you'll know when, in fact, you've got a need based on the preset limits, the PSI limits of that tire, to go put some air in. So our goal is to use current technology, which exists today, put it in our little controller, and let it be somewhat of a real help to the consumer, a reminder of, you know, you've probably got a need to go check your air, and when the little red light comes on that says you're down below that predetermined PSI level, definitely need to go check your air.
Which, Madam Chair, would be nice for a girl like me who had to roll out of her car twice yesterday to get that 35 to 40 PSI matched perfectly. So,
Madam Chair, the concept behind this tire is not to have a winter tire, but simply an all-year high-performance tire that just happens to have the ability to run in snow and ice when it's necessary. We haven't had much here this year, right? But we could have bad years coming up in Ohio, where I spend a lot of time lately, nothing but snow and ice. And they have been asking every week, how do we get these? And that's very encouraging.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand it correctly, the tire would properly put together, a peace officer could stop folks that where he sees the silica coming through bright colored and at that particular point lets them know that they're now out of rubberware.
That's correct.
Is there a training issue in that process, both to the driver and then to the officers that would be involved?
Each state, as I understand it, have varying laws regarding tread depth requirements. I'm not sure that Oregon has one. There are some that do that say at 230 seconds or 330 seconds the tire becomes illegal. And what we're hoping to do is make it easier for law enforcement to know when a tire is not channeling water with our tire, and hope that that encourages other tire makers to do something about the obviousness of tread wear to the consumer. Right now, if you have Lincoln's head trying to figure out how much tread you have left in your tire, somewhat of a confusing issue. Having silica built into the tread so that when that 430 seconds shows up and, oh boy, you know, maybe it's time to replace this, whether it has studs in it or not, we think is an excellent idea. I'm not sure I answered all of your questions, but
follow up if I may.
Yes.
I think that does answer it. And I guess I'm concerned about those folks who would not run these properly, would run 70,000-80,000 miles and still anticipate that they were going to get more wear because there's still some rubber on it, when in fact they're actually putting steel to the road in the summertime, and that would be a concern. But I did have another question, and that was, is the stud apparatus and the stud itself, is it compromised in any way in the event of a puncture in a flat?
We designed the tire as a self-fixing device. We'll supply with the consumer a plug system, so if they get out in the road somewhere and they have a problem, they can just simply pull a trigger on what looks like a little gun and put a plug in that chamber to seal it up. And then we've advised those that are preparing our tire for production, they need to have a similar device for all the tire retailers, so that if there is a hole that does get created, that we can fix it easily. What we've tried to do is maintain flexibility in these tires so that if a sharp object pushes against it, unlike just the tread itself, it has some give to it, so it's not near as likely to be pierced. But when that does happen, and it will happen, that there's a simple remedy in terms of a plug fix.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, I had a couple, but one got asked, and the other is, I know we're looking at this bill now, but how long do you anticipate before you would expect to see some of these tires on the road?
We will be in fleet testing in Akron, Ohio next week. We have a plant that's to be opened in the middle of July of this year. Our anticipation is that while product will be slow in coming out, like it is with any new product, we're not going to be able to if we do this right, we'll never meet our demand, but the idea is that by this year we'll have enough of these on the road to have a fairly significant response from consumers and retailers.
Representative,
you're right. I'm following up your question. So these will be manufactured in Oregon?
No. Right now we're in Ohio. And then we have a plant overseas. Unfortunately, the competition for building tires has excluded the U.S. market. It's very, very difficult to build a tire competitively here anymore. Almost all of tire manufacturing in Ohio, which was the birthplace of the tire industry, has gone elsewhere, unfortunately. We'll be one of the few tire makers in the state of Ohio.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I am, too. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Appreciate it. Amy Joyce.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I just handed in some written testimony, and just to follow up on the earlier witness, the department is in favor of anything that gives options to motorists. So we are neutral on this bill, but just to let you folks know that this gives an option to motorists to be able to use studded tire technology while also reducing wear and tear on the roads that can happen from studded tires. So the department views this as a good option, and that's about all I have to say.
Well, any questions for the department? And I guess I can ask one here. Does the department have any of the concerns that were raised about the overuse of the tire, or do they see any real problems with that?
Chair Beyer, I don't believe so. Our understanding is that the technology allows for the retraction of the stud, and folks are going to be wanting to maintain the investment that they make in this tire that's at a premium price. So we do not have those concerns.
Okay. Any other questions? No. I appreciate you coming up. Thank you. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2567. And thank everybody for coming. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2035.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2035 would reduce the number of convictions from 20 down to 15 for those necessary to revoke driving privileges of habitual traffic offenders. We have received a no revenue, still waiting on a fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jack Evans. Oh, yes.
I want some of those for my shoes.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans, Department of Transportation, and I'm here to talk to House Bill 2035, which is a concept that Representative Patty Smith brought forward. What it would do would be to reduce the number of offenses in one part of the habitual offender statute from 20 to 15. The way the program works at this time, there are two components. A person that's convicted of three very serious traffic violations within a five-year period would have their license revoked, and they'd be eligible within 5 years to apply for a new license. And those offenses involve any degree of murder or manslaughter or endangering an individual with an automobile, DUI, criminally driving while suspended or revoked, reckless driving, eluding a police officer, or failure to perform the duties of a driver. So any of those serious offenses, if you have three of them in a five-year period, you are deemed an habitual offender and your license is revoked. That accounts for about 94% of the cases that DMV deals with. The other 6% involve somewhat lesser offenses, and those an individual can also be part of the habitual offender program or deemed an habitual offender if they have a total of 20 or more of these other convictions. Of course, this can also include some of the more serious ones from the first category, but it's a total of 20, and they again would be would have their license revoked if they've got 20 of these convictions in a 5 year period. What the bill would do would be to deal with that latter category of individuals and reduce that number from 20 to 15. Right now we have a total of about 1,300 habitual offenders identified each year that have their licenses revoked. This would add another 500, so the total would grow to 1,800. On the effective date of this bill, individuals who have 15 or more convictions in the previous 5 years would still continue to be subject to the current law. but those that have less than 15 would fall under the provision of House Bill 2035. So what would happen in essence would be there'd be two tracking systems set up, one for individuals that are already over 15 so that they wouldn't immediately be subject to the program, and they would remain out of the habitual offender program until they hit 20. Everybody else who had less than 15 would become habitual offenders if and when they achieve that 15th conviction. So that becomes a significant tracking issue for DMV, and it causes a programming issue. We also would not be able to put this into effect until we estimate September of 2008 because of the competing needs for programming. We have a fix that we've identified and talked with Representative Smith about, and that would be instead of setting up two separate systems to have a system where basically looking forward, anyone that has 15 or more on the effective date of this bill, the next one makes them a habitual offender, and those that have less than 15 on the effective date, when they get to 15, they become a habitual offender. That creates a single system, and that would be more manageable. So that's the information I have available, and I'll answer any questions if you have.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, when would this go into effect? And I'm not clear from the act.
The bill would go into effect on the first of January 1st of 08.
Excuse me, follow up. Mm-hmm. Is that in the text of the bill? Am I just not seeing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I will need to look at the measure. I may just have imagined that it was the first year because we've been talking about not being able to make it by the first of the year. We'd have to go to September. So I'm just assuming that the intent is to have it to go into effect on January 1.
And Representative Buckley, unless it would specify otherwise or have an emergency clause in it, if that would be when it would take effect. So, yes, Representative Gilman.
Jack, could you get us a list of the other? We have the A through F, but I'd like to have the list of the other offenses.
Chair, by Representative Gilman, I'll do that. It's a fairly thick list. Basically, it's all moving violations. And it would include things like seatbelt not being attached, not wearing your seatbelt. That would actually count. Failure, being an improper lane change, speeding, any of these violations, they all count against the Habitual Offender Act. Also, if you have things like an equipment violation, however, a headlight is out or something like that, those would not count one for one, but they have a cumulative impact. They count as five of those count as one offense. So it's pretty much just about anything that you can be stopped for in a five-year period. When you accumulate now 20 of them, you'd be an habitual offender.
Okay, so it's
Yes,
thank you. So it's pretty much everything that's in the book. Does your recollection, does it include interfering with a funeral procession?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, it does. And as I look through the list, that's one that leapt out at me. Also, going the incorrect speed during a funeral. Some of those other funeral-related offenses are countable.
Any questions down here?
You're going to death me.
And Jack, I know you weren't around when we had this discussion in interim, but it's kind of eluding me why at that time they did decided on 15 as opposed to a different number?
Chair Beyer, do you mean how they settled on the initial number when they originally wrote the bill?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that was in 1973 when throughout the country there were these moves to develop these habitual offender statutes. And at that time, Representative Stan Bunn of the Oregon legislature worked with DMV and determined that there was a range of different things different states were doing. But they thought that they would go with the number 20, which seemed to be on the high end of the range that the other 8 to 15 states that were involved in developing these statutes. They went with the high end of that to capture the most egregious offenders rather than have a longer period of time or a smaller number of individuals. And it has remained at 20 to this day.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you by any chance know the demographic of the habitual offender?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I have a bit of a snapshot from March to May of 06. The seems to be weighted more heavily towards males. Of the 17 individuals in this sample, all but three are males. They range in age from 21 to 46, and I think the mean is in the kind of the mid-30s.
Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, we've been at 20 since 1973. And we would be moving to 15 of these violations. What have the other states done, and where will that put Oregon in relationship to other states?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I don't know the answer to your question, but I can certainly find out where other states are. We know that there's a range of different techniques. Some use the point system. Arizona's into the development of a point system. But I'll find out where we stand with respect to these lesser violations.
I would appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack, and I know it's a little early to be looking at any kind of fiscal on this, but I assume that this could be a little expensive.
Chair Beyer, it is. If it's implemented as written, we're looking at in the neighborhood of $500,000 with the it's a massive overhaul to the system to develop two parallel tracking systems. That, of course, is cut dramatically if you amend that. So, and that would also, as I mentioned, put it off from after the first of the year. We wouldn't be able to get it done because of competing time on the computer until September of 08.
Okay. So, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any projections that should this pass, what the net effect will be? Is there a projection on lives saved, accidents prevented?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know the answer to that question. It's interesting. I can certainly ask that. If we looked at what it would do would be sweep in another 500 habitual offenders, but what the actual impact would be on lives lost, reduced accidents, I can't say, but I can ask if that's known.
Oh, no, please don't. I'm just curious.
Thank you. Well, seeing no other questions,
ask one before you go.
Representative Tolman.
So, Mr. Evans, so if this bill were amended to put all drivers were subject to the new provisions with each additional conviction after the effective date of this bill, whenever that might be, then what might the cost be?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, it's estimated that would drop down to about
$15,000.
I've got to ask a question.
Representative
Smith.
I'm sorry.
Are you
feeling a little ornery. How is it that we could do this for $15,000, but a license plate is and a license plate is $11,000? Sorry. Let it go. I have all the respect in the world for MU Lottery.
Madam Chair, this is a committee bill, right? It's the interim committee bill.
Interim committee bill.
So if we were to be, is this appropriate to discuss this now?
Yes.
Okay. So if this committee were interested in drafting amendments so that it would be less expensive, how would we go about doing that? We would just ask as a committee?
Yeah. If that's what we are interested in. So let me know.
Madam Chair, I would certainly be interested in what other states look like with regard to while I think it's a good idea to start to crack down on habitual offenders, also think that this affects probably some of the poorest of the poor. I don't know that much about the demographics, but I'm going to guess that some folks just don't get it, and that we're going to be sweeping those 500 into the system. And there are going to be people that are probably going to come back and be driving without driver's license. That'll be the next time we'll see them after we sweep them into the system. And so I'm anxious to know that Oregon just didn't become the toughest state in the nation to drive cars, because chances are that you're really not going to drive them out of Oregon. You're just going to drive them onto the highways of Oregon with a greater habitual offender loss of license and those kinds of things. And at some point, then you're going to have actual corrections cost after a while we may be talking at somewhere between $15,000 and $500,000 cost for DMV, then you're talking about $50 to $75 million additional cost to corrections. So I'm anxious to know what other states are doing in that process, too. Thank you.
Representative,
Madam Chair, really a follow-up on Representative Smith's comment. If we can't show that we actually make the road safer by removing or hopefully removing these drivers, what have we accomplished?
And would there be a way to define, you know, how much safer the highways will be? I think that's where you have to look at some national data and other states where they have actually been successful in truly removing some of those folks. But I'm concerned at the number of folks that I see being prosecuted at this particular point that basically have no driver's license. I mean, they lost it because they were under the 20 points, the 20 convictions, and that didn't deter them. So I'm anxious of what that does. Excuse me, in terms of true cost to the system.
Right. Well, and we will have Jack get as many of those answers as he can. Thank you. Thank you for coming. And committee, we're going to be out of here early. I'm close the public hearing on House Bill 2035, and I'm going to adjourn the Transportation Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.